AFP Audio is today talking to Christine McDonald, who's the Director of the Department of Respiratory and Sleep Medicine at Austin Health and CEO of the Institute of Breathing and Sleep, also based at Austin. Hi, Christine.
Hi there.
So Christine is one of the authors of an article in the November 2012 edition of Australian Family Physician titled, Is It Okay For Me? Assessment of Recreational Activity Risk in Patients with Chronic Lung Conditions. So one of the things that increasingly we're seeing in society is people living with chronic conditions but still wanting to live life to the full and enjoy travel and hobbies. From what are some of the general considerations when someone with chronic lung disease is considering travel?
Well, I think obviously travelling, there are all sorts of issues to consider. Just general sensible things such as making sure that they have their a full complement of their medications with them, that they have an action management plan, I guess, with them. These are not necessarily terribly evidence-based, but it would make sense that they have discussed with their doctor what to do in case of an exacerbation and have some medication available that they can take, particularly if they're travelling to somewhere where medical assistance is not as readily available.
Okay, so in general, what are some of the considerations that there should be when someone with chronic lung disease is considering travel?
Yes, look, I think there are a number of sensible things that people can do. Obviously, they need to consider how long they're going to be away. Depending on the severity of their disease, if they have exacerbations of their asthma or COPD, I think it's wise for them to discuss with their treating doctor what sort of a plan of action they would take if they have a flare-up of their condition and take appropriate medications to manage that. I think, again, depending on what sort of activities, where they're going, what they're planning to do, for example, people with moderate to severe chronic lung disease hopefully may have already been a participant in a pulmonary rehabilitation program, but if not, if they're going to be planning to do a lot of walking or perhaps they might be going to somewhere that's somewhat at altitude, it may be important to really consider a fitness program. I mean, we would be recommending to patients with chronic lung disease that they keep fit in general anyway. That's one of our recommendations. And a pulmonary rehabilitation program is particularly useful, and the physiotherapists and others who may participate in such programs may be useful people to talk to and get tips from in terms of activities that they might be doing whilst they're away.
Yeah, so, and that's specifically all thinking about the chronic lung condition. And I suppose from a general practice perspective, we'll also have some other things we think about, like that normal travel health stuff like immunisations.
Of course.
Information.
Yeah,
so there's a whole lot of extra stuff from our end, but we've specifically asked you to think about the chronic lung disease elements.
Yes, of course. I mean, the other thing,
yep.
You know, clearly, again, in guidelines, patients with chronic lung disease, we would be recommending that they're up to date with their vaccinations. You know, they maybe want to consider some antibiotics to take with them, etc. So I guess I was thinking of those in terms of medications as well.
Yep. Okay, and so many trips to good places start with flying. What are some of the considerations when considering flying with chronic lung disease?
Yeah, now I just have to make you aware that this is a sort of fairly evidence-free zone.
Yep.
And a lot of these recommendations, as we've stated in our publication here, in our manuscript, are not strongly evidence-based. So there are guidelines, but the guidelines are based pretty much on consensus. So a lot of people with chronic lung disease do fly without mishap. I think that's the first thing to say. But people who are already have significant lung disease and maybe on home oxygen, particularly if they're on 16 hours a day or more, that is that they're chronically hypoxemic, we would recommend that they fly with oxygen, that they have oxygen to carry on the plane. Now, for people who have maybe some portable oxygen for exertional use, again, we would probably recommend that they take some oxygen with them, or at least advise the airline that they may need some oxygen on route. So the pressurised air cabin of a commercial aircraft, the inspired PO2 may fall to a value that would be the equivalent of breathing about 15% oxygen at sea level. people rather than the normal 21%. So everybody who flies will become to a slight extent hypoxemic. But if you're starting at a lower point on that oxygen desaturation curve, dissociation curve at least, then you may become significantly hypoxemic if you have chronic lung disease. And if that's the case, or if the saturations are lowish and or the arterial blood gases have been measured and the person is significantly hypoxic, then we can. There are a number of laboratories around the country where we can simulate high altitude and give the person an idea whether they desaturate significantly at altitude or at simulated altitude, and whether they might benefit from having some oxygen. Now, of course, there are no randomised controlled trials looking, giving people oxygen and not giving people oxygen and seeing whether they, have more mishaps or more difficulties at the other end or are more likely to develop an exacerbation on the aircraft, etc. But as I say, many people fly without mishap, but if there's a doubt, it's probably best to consider the use of oxygen during flight.
Yep, and the article I think makes the point that different airlines have different policies and availability People would need to contact prospectively.
They do very much. And I think we referred in the article to a study from some New Zealand colleagues who actually looked at this a couple of years back. But things will have changed probably since then. So I think, yes, I think that you have to just ring ahead and don't assume.
Yes. And the article then makes the point that generally if people have obstructive sleep apnea, it's suggested to try and, on a long-haul flight where they're hopefully going to sleep, to take their CPAP with them.
Well, I think that just sort of makes is common sense. Again, not because there's a lot of data, but because of it would improve how the patient felt at the end of their trip.
And once again, it's a contact the airline ahead, because once again, things will vary.
Exactly.
So altitude can be another consideration. What do we know about altitude and chronic lung conditions?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, there are people who live at altitude. That's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about people sort of living in Australia and going to somewhere where there'll be a rarefied atmosphere, a bit like going, I guess, up into a pressurised aircraft. However, there'll be the exercise that they're doing. So if they're going hiking or what have you, there's that to be considered as well. Not a lot of data, and we refer for someone who really does have a patient who's planning to do this and has significant lung disease. I would refer them to the Looks article there, which is quite a nice review article, quite relatively recent, 2007, talking about travel to high altitude for people with pre-existing lung disease. But basically, again, it's a sort of a common sense approach. In that article, there's a recommendation that people with significantly lowered FEV1, less than 1.5 litres, they say, again, that's probably not significantly evidence-based, but that they be assessed and perhaps be provided supplemental oxygen, again, in the same manner during high altitude travel, if their PO2 or predicted PO2 using either the high altitude simulation test or a regression equation, which these are available as well. So not everyone has access to the high altitude simulation test. So oxygen may be recommended. People may be exerting themselves, doing some trekking. So I would be recommending, just based on common sense, really, that they would need to be training and preparing for such a trip. I guess people should be able to do what they want to do, and people who have significant lung disease can do such trips, but I guess just a lot of planning and thinking about the possibilities is sensible.
Yes, and I mean, the article has a case study where someone goes to Machu Picchu, which all sounds good at 2,400 feet, but the detail of the itinerary is apparently the most common way there goes significantly higher.
You go up first and then come back down a little bit. Yeah, that's right.
So all of these sort of details are things that need time. time and to sort out the plans and then what the appropriate action should be.
Yeah, and that and in that setting, of course, it is recommended again, not because I really have had many patients go to Machu Picchu, but it is recommended that they would spend a bit longer and that they would acclimatise. And of course, you know, you're getting into all the situations of high altitude pulmonary edema as well, which if that occurred on top of their already pre-existing lung disease could be quite traumatic.
Yes. So. Yeah, indeed. I suppose perhaps a more common present or question that GPs in particular sort of often get first up is people who are often a bit younger and they're thinking about scuba diving and have some asthma.
Yeah.
But what in general are the sort of considerations around there?
Well, look, you know, this has really changed over recent times, I think, and I know that when we were preparing this article, there was one of the reviewers clearly had quite strong views about this, you know, that anyone who has any history of asthma at all should be counselled against diving. But the diving community, and especially the South Pacific Underwater Medicine Society group and their guidelines really are suggesting now that, particularly nowadays when asthma can be so well controlled, that if the person has been, you know, is well controlled and has no evidence of bronchial hyperresponsiveness on a test, so I think that's another thing to say. It's it would be probably, well, I think it behoves the physician or the general practitioner to organise a challenge test, you know, rather than just performing spirometry, because sometimes spirometry may be normal and yet the person may have significant bronchial hyperresponsiveness. So I think you really need the two components, normal spirometry, you know, clinically no symptoms or minimal symptoms and no evidence of bronchial hyperresponsiveness on testing. And if all those criteria are met, then current guidelines would suggest that diving may be permissible. And certainly this has really sort of come around, I guess, the sort of backdoor way in that a lot of information is collected by various organisations, including those who provide insurance for divers, about people who dive, and they are aware that many, many asthmatics dive safely. And I guess the sort of medical literature is only just starting to catch up with that. So there would still be people who would say it's not safe, but the guidelines do say with those caveats that it's probably not unreasonable.
Yeah, and I think that the term say, and the article uses an acceptable level of risk on acknowledging that nothing is no risk.
Nothing is perfect, yes. Life is imperfect, yeah.
Indeed. Excellent. And so in conclusion, what are some key messages that you hope a reader recalls after reading the article?
Look, I guess that so the key messages are that patients do take responsibility for their own health. I guess that's important, and that they, you know, that it's a shared care arrangement. You know, that there's a partnership between the general practitioner and the patient or person wishing to fly, dive, whatever it might be, and I guess that you would need to know the person well before advising them, and probably that this would, you know, this might need to take place on a couple of occasions, and that lung function testing is really important in terms of both of these sorts of trips in order to be able to advise the patient properly.
Excellent. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
And the article can be found in the November 2012 edition of Australian Family Physician.